Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is about a city in a state of panic, as with a young Muslim man running amok, armed with a knife, who had killed one person and injured five. As the press jumped to lazy conclusions and demonized him as a terrorist, they missed the fact that he was literally fighting demons of his own. Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 96. Zachariah Bulhan, the terrorist who never was. Today, I'm standing on Russell Square in Bloomsbury, WC1. Three roads east of the Charlotte Street robbery. Two roads west of the unusual death of Vera Crawford. Two roads northeast of the Denmark Place fire. And one road east of the deadly Mayo Brewery explosion. Coming soon to Murder Mile. On the opposite side of Soho, just over Tottenham Court Road, is Bloomsbury. A pricey residential area full of second homes for politicians, a huge university campus, and very little else except the British Museum, where overseas visitors all flock to see the treasures that we pinched from them many moons ago. Like the Elgin marbles.
Cheers, mate. I'll have that.
The Rosetta Stone.
Lovely jubbly. Chuck it in the van.
Egypt's famous cat mummies.
Nah, mate. We're not nicking it. We're liberating it.
And the Easter Island statue.
Yeah, I'll write you a receipt for it when I get it home. Bye, suckers.
Bloomsbury is a great place for tourists to find a hotel with a truly awful name reflecting very English things, such as the Windsor, the Churchill, the Dickens, the Battle of Britain, the 1966 World Cup, the Fry-Up, the Fit Princess, the Racist Prince, and the Pizza Express pedo. Tourists also flock here as it's local, peaceful, and safe. But during the summer of 2016, with the city on high alert and the police presence high, Russell Square was rocked by a murder and five attempted murders, all in the space of a few minutes. The grinning killer was described as a radicalized terrorist, hell-bent on death. When in fact, he was just a terrified boy who believed he was fighting for his life. As it was here, on the 3rd of August 2016, having armed himself with a large kitchen knife, that 19-year-old Zachariah Bulhan came with the intent to kill. But those he attacked were not his targets.
At 10:33 p.m, police responded to reports of a stabbing in Russell Square, just yards from the 7-7 bombing.
We can confirm that one woman is dead and several are critically injured. Eyewitnesses said that the killer was grinning.
He was skipping.
In a frenzied knife attack. Armed police tasered a young black man.
An Asian male. Described as either Iraqi or of Somali descent. Police are investigating links to terrorism and radicalization.
Once again, we ask the question, how safe are we, the British people, in our own city?
In the years after the 9/11 attacks, the tensions of the Western world were set on a knife edge. As no longer did a terrorist originate as an unscrupulous stranger from a foreign land, as many were now born and raised within the society they sought to destroy. But their targets wouldn't be military or political. As seeking to pummel the people into a state of absolute fear, they opted for soft civilian targets and indiscriminately killed as many bodies as possible, as these innocents went about their everyday lives. On the 7th of July 2005, suicide bombers exploded four devices on London's bus and tube network, killing 56 people, injuring 784, and inspiring a copycat attack just 2 weeks later. On the 26th, the 27th and the 28th of November 2008, in Mumbai, India, terrorists shot and killed 174 people, wounding at least 300. 22nd of May 2013, Royal Fusilier Lee Rigby was hacked to death in broad daylight by recent Islamic converts. 7th of January 2015, satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo is attacked. 12 are shot dead, 11 are injured. 13th of November 2015, in Paris, bomb attacks and mass shootings kill 130 people, 413 are injured. 14th of July 2015, Bastille Day in Nice. A 19-ton truck is used by its radicalized driver as a weapon. 86 people are dead, 458 are injured. And on the 22nd of March 2016, in Brussels, three suicide bombers kill 35 people and injure at least 300. And that was just a small sample, as by 2016, attacks by homegrown terrorists seemed to be hitting home soil on an almost weekly basis. And the perpetrators were almost entirely identical. Mostly Asian or black youths, with shaved heads, bushy beards, and innocent faces, who came from good families. But being bored, disillusioned, and deluded, they were radicalized into committing jihad. By the summer of 2016, the UK threat level had been increased to severe, meaning a terrorist attack was highly likely. Armed officers patrolled the streets. London Mayor Sadiq Khan called for the public to remain calm but vigilant. And ironically, on the 3rd of August 2016, Scotland Yard had announced that an extra 600 officers would be deployed into the city following the recent terror attacks. That night, in Russell Square, a young man of Somali origin went on a bloody killing spree, armed with a large knife, and his victims were white and Western. As always happens, we had to blame someone or something, whether drugs, music, films, bad parenting, or computer games. But in this case, our gut reaction was to blame it on his possible radicalization by a terrorist group based on his color. In truth, it was us who were to blame. We just couldn't see it or wouldn't see it. Zachariah Bulhan wasn't a crazed terrorist on a mission from God. He was just a frightened young boy who needed our help. Zachariah's parents were born and raised in Somalia, an East African country bordered by Ethiopia, Kenya, and the Gulf of Aden. As an unstable region, steeped in poverty, corruption, and ethnic tension, as warlords, armed militia, and government forces fiercely ripped the impoverished nation apart. In 1991, when its British rulers unceremoniously dumped yet another dirt-poor country, it had stripped of all its assets. The second we graciously granted Somalia its independence, it descended into a bloody civil war. So violent were the clashes that in December 1992, the United Nations peacekeeping force intervened, and the civil war remains in place to this day. Seeking a better life, Zachariah's parents fled war-ravaged Somalia to join their relatives in the calmer, cooler, and more peaceful country of Norway. 3 years later, with an older sister, Sigal, and later followed by a younger brother, Salah, Zachariah was born, and he was healthy, happy, and bright. In 2002, having emigrated to Britain, the five-strong Bulhan family moved into a small council flat on the second floor of Robertson House in Tooting, South London. They worked hard, they lived well, and they raised their children to be good, decent people, with a smile on their faces and love in their hearts. It was an unremarkable upbringing, typical of many families. They had their ups and downs, their struggles and successes, and although Zachariah's parents would eventually split, for the sake of their children, his mother remarried, his stepfather moved in, and Zachariah remained in contact with his own father. So it's no surprise that the other tenants described them as the best neighbours you could ever hope to have. Zachariah, nicknamed Zaki, was a perfect example of a good upbringing by devoted parents who gave him love and support. Raised by a lady who everyone said was delightful, Zachariah modelled himself on his mother. And although shy and socially awkward, being described as a little gentleman, he was always polite, helpful, and charming, having been blessed with a baby face and a big bright smile. Zachariah didn't have a bad bone in his body or an evil thought in his head. But by the end of 2015, 6 months before the attack, things had started to go wrong. Nineteen-year-old Zachariah had struggled with mental illness for the last 4 years. What began with anxiety and depression was brushed aside by his GP as a phase that many teenagers experience and grow out of. But as he aged, being cursed by a stigma surrounding mental illness in Somali culture, which makes them less likely to seek treatment, his symptoms only escalated the more he sought to suppress it. Becoming more isolated, Zachariah stopped going out, ceased seeing his friends, and he even quit his college course. Withdrawing within his own mind, his cheeky face became sullen. His beaming smile was erased and replaced by a terrified grin, and his once eager eyes were etched red, as with a boy too frightened to ever fall asleep. Over the next 6 months, Zachariah would try to kill himself 3 times. On the 20th of April 2016, as an outpatient at the National Hospital for Neurology on Queen Square, Zachariah was initially diagnosed with anxiety and a depressive disorder. His symptoms were a perfect fit: sleeplessness, irritability, isolation, depression, lack of motivation and concentration. And given that he had no history of violence to anyone but himself, he was deemed a low risk prescribed antipsychotic medications, and he was monitored by the mental health team. But as the science still in its infancy, it is often said that a person's mental health isn't correctly diagnosed for the first 10 years, as many symptoms can be suppressed, masked, and can even incubate until they are triggered. And Zechariah's diagnosis was no exception. By May 2016, as he withdrew further from the routine of an ordinary life and hid in his bedroom, his hygiene was poor, his thoughts were muddy, and he struggled to see where reality began and ended. Entirely out of character, an unusually volatile anger rose within him, causing his mother to hide the kitchen knives as she worried what he may do. But it wasn't a hatred that fueled his fury, but a fear. No longer could Zechariah tell the difference between spoken words and imaginary ones, as a ceaseless cacophony of voices tortured him day and night, convincing the terrified boy that he was possessed by a devil. Only able to trust his own brain to tell him the difference between right and wrong, even his senses colluded against him. As in his head he heard voices, in his eyes he saw demons, and on his tongue he tasted sulfur. After his arrest, Zechariah would finally be diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And all the warning signs were there that he was about to enter a full sensory schizophrenic psychosis. But this diagnosis would come too late. Deemed a low risk, prescribed a mild drug, and with his psychiatric help on a strictly voluntary basis, by the summer of 2016, he wasn't a powder keg of religious anger and anti-West hatred. What was bottled up inside him was absolute terror, as the demons inside his mind conspired against him. And yet, it was all hidden behind the smile of a sweet-faced angel who would never harm a fly. Wednesday the 3rd of August 2016 began as an unremarkable day. There were highs of 25 degrees, blue skies, and a cool breeze. The summer had started, the city was busy, and the public holiday had begun. So Mrs. Bulhan and her youngest son went to visit her family in Holland, as Zechariah stayed with his dad. 3 miles from Russell Square, in Whitechapel, Zechariah and his father walked into the East London Mosque for their late afternoon prayer. Being devout Muslims, this was the third of 5 salats for the day, and to aid Zechariah's recovery, they prayed to Allah and were counseled by the Imam. Stigmatized by a cultural shame of mental health, a distrust of modern medicine, and a belief that their faith could conquer all, they did what they thought was right. But paranoid schizophrenia doesn't adhere to the 7 pillars of Islam. It barely complies to the laws of medical science. And when psychiatric counselling is left to the patient's discretion, it's as good as useless. Especially when the only voices he could trust were the ones inside his head. Somewhere in the mosque, a telephone rang, as it had many times before. But gripped in a paranoia that everyone was conspiring to kill him, Zechariah panicked. He ran. A moment later, he had vanished. That night, fearing for his life, Zechariah couldn't remember where he ran, who he saw, or what he did. Terrified that his mobile phone was bugged, he threw it into a bush. Fearing that the plain white robe he had worn into the mosque was poisoned, he stripped down to a white t-shirt black tracksuit trousers and a pair of trainers. And as the people were spies, their eyes were cameras, and their spit cast cruel spells upon him. As the devil closed in, to protect himself, he stole an 8-inch kitchen knife. Zachariah was alone and terrified. Security footage briefly captured the boy wandering aimlessly, but his movements were confused and chaotic. Everyone was a threat and a danger, and although he fled, as the demons chased him, he was unaware that they weren't behind him, but inside him. Somehow, maybe as an automatic response to seek a safe place, he ended up at the National Hospital for Neurology on Queen Square, where his illness was first diagnosed. But as a non-emergency service, it was shut. So unsure what to do, the lost and frightened boy wandered around the dark, foreboding city. With a voice in his head, a demon on his back, and a knife in his hand. Just one street from Russell Square. At 10:27 p.m, as the theatres emptied, the restaurants refilled, and the pubs readied for last orders, entirely by chance, six strangers converged on Russell Square. They were all of different ages, and they were all from different places. They were just six people, chosen at random, who were enjoying life. They had never met before, but across the next 6 minutes, their lives would be fatally intertwined. They were 67-year-old Bernard Heppelwhite, a conservation volunteer from Kent, who had been to the theatre with a friend. 23-year-old Lily Stalentin, an Australian primary school teacher who was just yards from her hotel. 64-year-old Darlene Horton, a special needs teacher who had enjoyed a final meal with her husband before her flight back to Florida. As well as 59-year-old US national Martin Honish, 40-year-old Australian David Imber, and 18-year-old Israeli Yovel Lukowski. Only Zachariah wouldn't see them as people. As in his eyes, every one of them was a demon. As the baby-faced boy weaved about the busy pavement, to his first victim, Bernard, Zachariah didn't look like a threat. As the small cherubic boy skipped along silently, swinging his arms like he was playing in the park. As the boy banged into him, Bernard uttered an ouch. Only then did he realize that he hadn't been punched in the stomach. He had been stabbed. And as Zachariah joyously skipped on, grinning wildly, after years of terror, the petrified boy had finally slain his first beast. Yards behind him, it all happened so fast that before Bernard even knew that he was bleeding, as the emotionless prancing lad approached his next victim, Lily Stalentin felt a sharp pain in the right of her ribs. As with no shouts of triumph and no cries of relief through his gritted teeth, Zachariah skipped on silently as a second beast was slain. From out of nowhere, screams began. Someone shouted,
"He's got a knife!"
And although two people lay bleeding, as this wasn't a TV fiction, but a reality in life, no one was quite sure what was happening. As Zachariah darted over the road, approaching a couple silently from behind, with a single fast blade, he stabbed Darlene Horton in the back. Unaware of her injuries, her husband gave chase, only for the small-framed lady to slump against the garden gates, as an odd dark pattern formed down her back. By now, everyone was watching. People were screaming. And as distant sirens grew closer, with a seizure of flashing blue lights illuminating the entire square, as patrol cars of armed officers flooded the streets, Zachariah ploughed on as a third beast was down and dying. In quick succession, as Zachariah ran past the Imperial Hotel and dashed up Russell Square towards Bedford Place, he stabbed three more innocents. Martin Honish in the armpit, David Imber in the chest, and Yovel Lukowski in the right arm. But as the screams echoed, the sirens wailed, and the people scattered, suddenly Zachariah realized he was alone, with no more beasts to slay. Within minutes of the attack having begun, armed officers had tasered, subdued, and arrested Zachariah. Six people were injured, two seriously, and having been stabbed in the lung and the heart, Darlene Horton was later pronounced dead. But for once, the demons in Zachariah's head had ceased. As happens during any moments of panic, misinformation had spread in those crucial few minutes. As some eyewitnesses had claimed that he had shouted, "Allah, Allah," whereas others had said that he was silent. And although we may all say that we're not inherently biased, if a white person goes on a killing spree, we usually call it a mass murder. But if the perpetrator is dark-skinned, we often assume it's terrorism. To quash any rumours by the trashy tabloids, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, said that mental health remains a substantial focus in our investigation, and reiterated that they were keeping an open mind as to the motive. Zachariah Bulhan was arrested, charged, and having been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, he was sent to Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison, where he was finally diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. On the 7th of February 2017, Zachariah Bulhan was tried at the Old Bailey. And although he had no memory of the attack, he pleaded guilty to one count of manslaughter by diminished responsibility and five counts of wounding with the intent to cause grievous bodily harm. But as it was universally accepted that he had suffered an acute psychotic episode, he was detained at Broadmoor Hospital, where he would remain for the rest of his life. One person was dead, five people were injured, and a young boy's life was destroyed forever. Had he got the help he needed, had we seen the warning signs, and had not just his culture, but ours, not been blighted by a stigma surrounding mental illness, then a good boy who was polite, shy, and decent would be living a good life today. And although we're all terrified by the spectre of terrorism, often the biggest demons we need to fight aren't on the outside, but are the ones inside our minds. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. After the break, I shall be discreetly slurping a tea, crinkling a cake wrapper, but probably not eating it, droning on endlessly about something or other, and then I shall press stop. Thank God. Before that, a big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Bernard Ehrlich and Stephen Walker. I thank you. Plus a thank you for all the new 5-star reviews you've been leaving on your favourite podcast app. They're very much appreciated and really do mean a lot to me. Murder Mile is researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh dear, do that. Whoa, throat is hurting after that. Whoa, lots of voices to do, lots of voices, lots of... And the demon voice. Oh dear. Oh, although I seem to... That started as a really slow record. I was really struggling at the start, but then I think I got into my flow. So hopefully it will be a pig to edit, because I'm already picturing all the sounds and the demon voices and things like that. And, oh, that's going to be a four-dayer, I think, to edit that one. But whew, hopefully it'll be worth it. Right, hello everyone. Extra mile time. We're here. I was just trying to whiz through that because not whiz through it, like rushing through it, but. Just over me, because some of the businesses are starting to open up. There seems to be a workshop opposite me, and they've got like a bandsaw going just down, like four boats down. There's a guy with an angle grinder. He's got his angle grinder out. And my immediate neighbour to the right, nice guy, but he's doing a lot of angle grinding, and he's going to turn up soon. So I'm desperately rushing around trying to get this done. And I can hear someone with a strimmer as well, because the field in front of me is full. The grass is really high. You remember last week the tractor was out. The tractor didn't do a big job. It basically went around and it cut basically a pathway for people to walk through, and that was it. So, whew, right, let's get some windows open. Oh, if you're new to Extra Mile, this is the waffly bit. I talk, I give you some more information. I have a cup of tea. I look at a cake, which I don't eat during the show because it can be a bit noisy. All the mouth sounds, and that's about it. And I don't edit anything out, which is nice. It's different. The first bit takes like 4 days to edit, 3 or 4 days to write, sometimes a week, 2 weeks to research. It's a real pig, that first half an hour bit. The bit that everyone listens to and goes, oh yeah, I listened to that, blah, 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 blah. That's the hard bit. This is the easy bit. I do nothing with this. I just waffle and I don't edit anything out. It's a piece of piss. It really is. Right. Gonna make a cup of tea. Yes, I gotta make a cup of tea. Just had my coffee, it wasn't nice. Oh, Jesus, bright. You can probably hear the workshop now. People have to work, I get it. Oh, it's gonna fill up my tea. Water in there. Hang on. Oh, there you go, kettle on. Tea bag in, two sugars as always, milk at the ready, powdered, and Belgian buns. Yeah, kind of running short on new ones. I still haven't found those those Bakewell tart McVitie's. I haven't found them yet, and I'm desperate not to try them. Although I might go back to those hint of marmalade. Marmalade on toast McVitie's, they were really nice. I might try and hunt them down again. They were great. But today it's back on the Tesco's Belgian buns. Although I have said to myself I may need to go on a diet because the sideways view is not looking good. Looking very, 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 very round. Very, very round.
I only have one mirror on the boat, and it's in the bathroom. I turned sideways the other day, and I was like, oh, no, what happened to the nice skinny me? Christmas time, I was nice and skinny, and I was like, oh, I think I'll just have one cake. And I think I did well up until February, I think. Yeah, these last couple of weeks are really packed on the pounds. Anyway, so this is my penultimate week before I have to move on. We're given our marching orders, so the boats have to move on very soon. I don't think I've got any tours for a while, because I don't think there'll be kind of public meetings and things like that. I think will be the last thing that'll be allowed, even though we're outdoors. Also, the last thing I want to do is a tour, and then halfway through, I have dickheads coming up to me going, hey, coronavirus, you can't be doing tours in the coronavirus, and yet they're out shopping. So I'm going to hold off to doing the tours until I'm 100% certain that I feel that I'm not contributing to, you know. I know people are going to start rushing out and shopping now, and everyone's like, oh, do you know, the virus doesn't exist anymore, do you know, because we all believe that the lockdown isn't eased, it's off. But obviously the virus doesn't get the memo. I don't want to be a part of that. I would rather, you know, even if there's no tours this year, I would rather do it as long as we're all safe. I think that's most important to me, rather than going, oh, I need to make some money. So I will continue being poor for as long as it keeps us all safe. And that's what the way it's going to be. So, but as mentioned before, if you've got vouchers, don't worry. I'll keep extending those. And anyone who has booked on the tour for any approaching dates, I'll be in touch with you, as I always am, about a week before. And what I've started doing is putting your tickets in a holding pattern, so I can kind of, when they're up and running, I can get in touch and go, right, your tickets are ready for whenever you want them, so we can book you back on. So you don't need to worry, they won't be lost at all. What's going on here? It's bloody hot here. We were having a week of, I think it's like mid-20s. Which I know is not hot for everyone else, but for me, it's too bloody hot. I like the cold. I like cold, I like wind, I like rain. I don't like heat. Not a big fan of heat, because there's nothing you can do about it. So, and especially when you're sitting inside a metal box, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. So, oh dear. Tea's about to go. Look at that, it's ready to go. Yes, tea o'clock. There we go. Pop that in there, let it stew. Good. Milk ready. Well, powdered milk ready. Staying here, obeying the rules. I'm going to bugger off on the boat somewhere else, as mentioned, somewhere secret. So that'll be good. Still adhering to the rules of the lockdown. Still doing online kind of e-quizzes and e-beers with friends. But I'm getting really bored of e-beers and e-quizzes. Luckily, the rules do say that you can meet someone from another household. And as long as you're 2 meters apart, and you know, and you're outside, and things like that. So I will be meeting up again with a friend tonight, which is all good. Going to go over to his, have a couple of beers, which is quite nice. It's nice to have beers and talk face to face with someone. But because he's a carer for the NHS, obviously we keep our distance. We've got our gloves on, and you know, it's funny, but it's nice just to talk to someone directly to their face. So we'll be doing that. Right, have a couple of cheeky beers. Looking forward to that. No, having beers via Skype, it's just I'm not enjoying it. Not enjoying it at all. It just feels like a waste of an evening. I like sitting in front of someone and just talking to their face. You know. You're missing a lot when you're not seeing someone. Right, anyway, let's do the questions, then I'll go and put my milk in the tea. But powdered milk, obviously. Right, questions number one. Get yourselves ready. Question one. Start with a really easy one. What country did Zachariah's parents originate from? Nice and easy, right at the top of the show. Question two. Which mosque did Zachariah go to with his father? Nice, easy one as well, I think. Question three. Which prison was Zachariah admitted to at the end? This is a hospital/maximum security prison. That was after he was arrested. Question four. Which road was Zachariah arrested near? So it's just off Russell Square, but which road was it? Question number 5. What was Zachariah studying at college? Question 6. What caused Zachariah to flee when he was in the mosque? It was a physical thing. Something happened. What was the thing that triggered his panic? Question 7. Who was the only person who was killed in the attack? What was their name? Question 8. Which part of South London did Zachariah live in? This place was on Twitter all over about 2 weeks ago because an experimental drive-through McDonald's had opened up in London because, you know, obviously people are desperate for their mucky doos. And it went all over Twitter because people couldn't believe that there was a place in the country in Britain which had that name. For us, we're kind of used to it, but people outside London couldn't believe that that was the name of a real place. It is. Question 9. How many extra police officers did Scotland Yard announce would be on the street that morning? Ironically, the morning that Zachariah committed the attack. An easy one. Question 10. What was Zachariah's nickname? Right, let's go and put my powdered milk in. It's like being in the war. It's rationing. I think I should go and get myself some powdered. Ow, that's hot. I think I should get myself some powdered egg as well. Who knows? Maybe with the virus, maybe we will go but to some kind of rationing system. You know, you never know. If some other countries start shutting down. Because don't forget, a lot of us don't produce our own stuff anymore. We actually rely on imports. So who knows? Right, let's get some extra information in here. Obviously, I'd heard about this case years ago. I was working a couple of roads away when it happened. Heard about it. Heard it all unfold. So when I was going through all the cases that I wanted to cover, I thought this would be an interesting one to cover, and I kind of knew how I wanted to tell it as well. That it was going to be his story, not the victim's stories. I think there's a lot of coverage. There was a lot of coverage on that, but I felt that was already covered. I wanted to cover his side of the story. And also to kind of get across the way that the media panics quite often. So that's what this story is about. Obviously, as mentioned, there were 5 people who were stabbed. There was one fatality that night. I'm gonna give away that. I'll try not to give away the name of the lady. So there's one lady who's died. She's stabbed at the scene. I'm not gonna mention her name because it's in the quiz. Let's see. She was, as mentioned, she was from Tallahassee in Florida. She was a special needs teacher. She'd been working with young people with disabilities and mental illness. It's kind of the irony of it is that, you know, she went out of her way to kind of help these young people with mental illnesses, and she was killed by someone with mental illness. She was on a holiday with her husband, Richard. They're in London. It was their last night in London. They'd just gone out for a nice meal. They were going to get the flight back the next morning. Unfortunately, she was stabbed at the scene. It was a single stab wound. It went right through her lung and her heart. She died within minutes. Paramedics were on the scene, literally. Within minutes as well, but because there's quite a few hospitals nearby, but unfortunately she didn't make it. She died at the scene. Bernard Heppelwhite, who was the first victim, he suffered a large tear to the lower bowel, which required surgery. He was in hospital for 7 days, and this left him with a degree of physical disability. Obviously all these people were able to put an impact statement at the court case about how it had affected their life. He said in his impact statement that for the rest of his life he will carry the physical and mental scars of what happened to him that night. His life has been changed for the worse and forever. Lily Salentin, who was the Australian primary school teacher, she was stabbed in her right flank and was left with a permanent scar. She had to take antiviral medication for a month and endured fear that she might have been exposed to HIV and other infectious diseases, because obviously, you know, the same knife had stabbed other people. The experience took a toll on her psychologically, and in her impact statement, she did not think she would have to go through counselling for a traumatic event when she was just enjoying her life and living it to the full. There were three other victims in there who I mentioned very briefly at the end. Their injuries weren't actually too bad. They were able to be discharged from hospital. But those were the ones who, obviously, you know, you got physical injuries, but also the psychological injuries as well. As mentioned, there was a real media hysteria around it. Obviously, the press were kind of all geared up for, you know, terrorism, things like that. The second that people found out that he was black, that he was Somali, already at that point, people had already kind of said that eyewitnesses had said, you know, eyewitness statements that night are really vague. Like, one of them said he was wearing a motorcycle helmet, and I had to keep going back through all the details and going, why is he wearing a motorcycle helmet? And there's no reference to him on a motorbike or a motorcycle helmet at all. So that's incorrect. One of them said that, as mentioned in the story, that he was shouting Allah, Allah, but this is doesn't seem to make sense because everyone else said that he's silent. Someone else said that he had an Islamic pamphlet in his back pocket. That was mentioned in court, but it wasn't used as evidence, as the judge said it was not unnecessary. It didn't actually serve a purpose. As if you go through any of the press reports, this may stay in the program. I don't know whether it will. I mentioned in there that the last lady who was attacked, the 18-year-old Israeli lady, obviously the good journalists got in there and they decided to focus on the victims and their lives and all that, but obviously the junk press that were there, they went, oh, she's an attractive lady, and then they went on her Instagram account and they found, oh wow, she's got loads of pictures of her in her bikini. So if you go and look at their reporting, I'm going to say it now, the Daily Mail, piece of crap that it is, if you go on there, it's basically just there's pictures of the lady who was stabbed and, you know, scenes around that, all the glorified stuff, and then pictures of this lady in a bikini. And you just think, it's not really reporting, is it? You just sensationalist twaddle. What else we got? Obviously, there was a brief... The more information that came out about him, obviously, some people said that he was Somali, which he was. Some people said he was Iraqi. Do you know, obviously, people take a kind of reactionist view on this. And instead of just going, you know, saying that he might be from one country, they try and pick the country where there's wars in. They go, oh, well. The second that the press found out that he had Norwegian relatives and that he was actually born in Norway, obviously the people had already started to connect up a kind of a subliminal link between Anders Breivik, who was the guy who went on the killing spree and killed all those kids. But unfortunately, this is the what I was trying to get across in this episode, is that people do make an irrational... They have to make irrational connections, but what the connection normally is that they want to put the blame somewhere else. They want to put the blame on other people, on religions, on music, and things like that. But what they don't want to do is say, hey, you know, this is part of our problem. This is... We all have an inherent stigma against mental health, you know. So, and even though I'm referencing here, that it is true that with the Somali culture, there is very much a kind of a stigma against mental health. I try to remember the name of the book. It was the book I was deliberately reading about Somali culture, and the author was like, there is a big problem in Somali culture, that they literally just put their hands up to it and go, no. But unfortunately, we all are the same as well. We all have that as well. It's still something that we're all need to kind of process and deal with properly, as opposed to just, and even worse, just saying, oh, it's just mental health. That's even the worst thing as well, is we're just boxing everything up. Let's whiz on. What else we got? As mentioned, the UK threat level is at severe. It's a five-stage threat level. Severe is the second highest. Obviously, the top one is means that an attack is imminent. Very rarely do we ever get to that point. I think most of the time at the moment, it's at severe. It seems to be. I wonder what it's at now, because with the coronavirus, if you notice, it's very little terrorism. I think because the terrorists know that the virus is doing a better job than they're doing. So they're just sitting back and letting it happen. Also, they probably can't travel that much or get equipment. But, you know, I think that the virus is doing a better job. And you know what? Our leaders are doing an equally damaging job than a terrorist would do. Ugh, bloody politicians, eh? Let's see. What else do we have here? I'm just having a whiff through all my details. Obviously, immediately after the attacks, they got his details. They went back to the flat where he lived. Went through all his equipment, examining his computer and stuff like that. But there was nothing on there. Obviously, the police were looking for some kind of connection to radicalization, things like that. But there was none of that at all. It was literally, they went in and they just found out he was literally just an ordinary boy, liked football, he liked computer games, stuff like that. And he was obviously, they found his medical papers as well. He received a treatment at a secure mental health hospital, which is Broadmoor. He'd been there literally almost after his arrest. He was sent there, and he'd been there for about 3 weeks, so they could properly assess him. It's a maximum security prison and hospital. But by the time it got through the court system, everyone kind of, whether prosecution or defence, everyone had said, you know, you can't sentence him, you can't put him in prison, because he really, really does need, he needs help. So under the Mental Health Act, that his sentence was custody for life under a hospital order, which basically means he'll be there forever. Unless he does well and comes through this. Let's hope something good happens for him. What else we got? What else we got? Do you know what? I think I put almost everything into the episode. As mentioned, so the trial was on the February 2017, so about 7 months later. It was at the Old Bailey, as always. Took them a couple of days. What else have we got? Originally, so obviously he was charged with murder originally, but it was murder, one count of murder, five counts of attempted murder, which they say him, but obviously it's his lawyers who make the decisions on this. But he said not guilty to murder and five counts of attempted murder, but admitted manslaughter by diminished responsibility and five counts of wounding with the intent to cause grievous bodily harm, which the pleas were accepted by the prosecution, given the fact that he was quite clearly suffering, you know, a paranoid episode. That it kind of made sense for the prosecution just to accept that plea deal there. The court heard that Bulhan was having an acute episode of paranoid schizophrenia at the time of the attacks. What else we got? What else we got? The judge ordered the attempted murder charges to lie on file. So it's marked on the file, but it doesn't mean that he'll be charged with it. They all agreed that he had suffered from mental illness since the age of 15. So it'd been going on for about 4 years, and it had reached a crescendo in August that year. What else we got? I'm trying not to give away too much, because obviously we've got the quiz next. And I don't want to ruin any of that for you. What else we got? No, I think we're done. I think we're done on that. Yeah. So he's currently still there. He's currently in Broadmoor Maximum Security Prison. He's going to be there for a very long time. But obviously,
But, do you know, as mentioned in this before, do you know, they do always say that with mental health, it takes about 10 years to get a proper diagnosis because it's not clear. There's so many different diagnoses and that they all overlap. And quite often, diagnoses kind of shift as well. We kind of noticed this with my mum as well. It was kind of, do you know, there was nothing stable or consistent. Like the one doctor would go, oh, it's this. And then the other one would go, oh, it's this. I remember sitting around a big table with loads of experts. I'm gonna use inverted commas because there were a lot of them sitting around the table who were, they were experts, but it was, they were really arrogant. And it was, and they were like, I'm Professor da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, and doing all that. I'm Dr. da-da-da, and it's like showing off to each other how great they were. And when it came around to me, it went, hi, I'm the son of da-da-da. I've got 42 years experience of this patient. And it was like, oh, there was one person around the table who looked at me and they were like, oh, that was a good answer. Because even though they were medical experts, I was the only person in the room who understood her, the person. And it was very interesting, like going around the table and all these teams had come together to discuss mum's case. I'm not going to say what she had. And one group said, well, we've noticed this, this, this. So we think it's this diagnosis. And then the other group went, oh, well, that can't be right because we've noticed this, this and this. But we haven't noticed that. So we think it's this. And then another group went, no, that's not right because we've seen this, this and this. But we haven't seen that or that. And then they all got together and went, how can she be presenting different symptoms to different people? And I was like, welcome to my world. But that's mental health for you. It all overlaps. It's so, yeah. So even though, you know, you may listen to this and go, oh, do you know, the hospital didn't do a good job or the GP didn't do a good job. The problem is it is a hard job. You can't, no, GPs have what, 10 minutes to diagnose someone and 3 minutes of that is to do the paperwork. How is that even possible? And then if you go, even if you go into a mental health facility, the chance of them getting it right first time is slim. So they do often say it can take 10 years to get the mental health diagnosis accurate. And symptoms lie low. They can come up at different points. They can overlap. They can... You can have multiple mental health problems at the same time. Do you know, it might not just be depression. It could be anxiety. It could be paranoia. Do you know, they could be of different strengths and levels. Do you know, there's nothing consistent inside the human brain. So it's a hard one. It really is. But, you know, hopefully with this story, hopefully this has helped make changes to people who need help out there. So, right. Let's do the answers to the questions. Right. I'm looking at those cakes. Oh, although they have been sitting there for about 2 days, so they might be a little bit sweaty. Still going to eat them. Right. Question number one. What country did Zachariah's parents originate from? The answer was Somalia. Question number two. Which mosque did Zechariah go to with his father? it was the East London Mosque in Whitechapel. Huge mosque. If you go down through Whitechapel, it's actually past Whitechapel Hospital, which was where the John Merrick, or actually Joseph Merrick, the Elephant Man, was for a big part of his treatment. And it's not too far away. It's actually just opposite Brick Lane, kind of, and that's why the bomb went off in Brick Lane, because if you go back to episode five, the Admiral Duncan bombing, it was the second bombing that was done, and that's why it was there, because it's right next to one of the biggest mosques. Question three: which prison was Zechariah admitted to? That was Broadmoor Psychiatric Prison. Question four: which road was Zechariah arrested near? That is Bedford Place. Question five: obviously, I should mention at the start, if some of these questions might not be in the episode because I might have edited them out. Question five: what was Zechariah studying at college? He was doing a BTEC in IT. Question six: what caused Zechariah to flee when he was in the mosque? It was a phone ringing. Question seven: Who was the only person who was killed in the attack? There, I did it. I didn't mention her name in the bit. It was Darlene Horton. So she was the lady. She was walking with her husband Richard along, not along the side roads, but along the railings in the middle of the park. And he came up behind her and stabbed her in the back, right through the left lung and the heart. She literally bled out, died really quickly. Question eight. Which part of South London did Zachariah live in? And that is, of course, Tooting. Freedom for Tooting. Question nine. How many extra police officers did Scotland Yard announce would be on the street that very morning? They announced 600 police officers, many of them armed. And question 10. What was Zachariah's nickname? Even if you didn't hear it, it'd be easy to guess. It was Zachy. Nice, easy nickname. Good. That was that. Oh, right. Time to... Oh, shit. I pressed a button that I shouldn't have pressed. And now I... Oh, man. What have I done? There we go. I'm back. I pressed a button. Good. That's me done. I'm going to go and have a tea and a cake. And I'm going to power through this, get myself ready, and then head over to my mate's house at about 6:30 and have some cheeky beers. Yeah, cheeky beers. Oh, can't wait. Good. Anyway, that was that. Hope you're all staying safe, being good. Don't flout the rules. Stay within the limits. The virus is meant to be coming back next month, so over in July, and meant to be a third push in October. So stay down, stay safe. Don't forget that the virus doesn't adhere to the same rules as you. It didn't get the memo about the lockdown being eased. It's a virus. It does its own thing, and it mutates as well. So do you know what? Be safe. Just play it safe and be good and healthy and safe, and don't be a dickhead about it, because if you're a dickhead about it, you could make other people ill. And that's the kind of... I think that's the key thing at the moment, is a lot of people are going, oh, but I don't have the symptoms. I don't feel like I've got symptoms. But it's like, yeah, but you could have. That's the problem. Like, I've actually seen in the streets a lot of kids running around. Their parents have let their kids go feral now. And they're like, ah, sod it. You go out and have some fun. But the problem is, the kids may not show the symptoms, but the kids can be carriers. And that's the problem. You've got all your kids mixing and they come back into the house. They bring the virus with you and then you spread it onto someone else. One day. Right. Everyone be safe. Be good. I'm going to have cake and I will speak to you all soon. Have yourselves a good week. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that.
Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.